Hello, this is a podcast for numbers people who don't always get their numbers listened to by the rest of the organization. What I'm going to do here is something I rarely do outside the confines of a cup of coffee with a friend, but I'm going to step back and think about organizations and try to give you some advice as an analytical person, because I empathize with where you're coming from. As an analytical person, it might be useful for your career. Now, the studies, the things that I'm talking about here are not things that they've had studies on, and so there's not a research literature that says what I'm about to say to you. But this is just my advice after looking into organizations for 30 years and thinking about the struggles of organizations, and also particularly the struggles of analytical people in large organizations. It's clear to me that if you're an analytical person, the superpower that you have with respect to making numbers count is extrapolation. Let's take the example of the frog dunking a basketball, or person with the abilities of a frog dunking a basketball. So it's true that there are a number of species where frogs jump several times their body length. What does that mean if we translate that into human scale? Well, you can do the calculations, and the calculations are remarkable. The calculations say that not only could you dunk as a high school player, not even an NBA draft player, you could dunk from the free throw line, you could also dunk from the three-point line, and even the three-point line of the other team's court. And that's something that you wouldn't know unless you did the extrapolation to figure it out. One of my favorite examples in the book is talking about the venture capital industry in Silicon Valley a couple of decades ago. It had the dot-com boom, and they were raising a round of money as venture capitalists that wound up being about $200 billion. Now, historical rates of venture capital were 18% returns. That's what turned a lot of people onto it, turned universities onto that as a part of their endowment. They liked having that sum of money. But the question was, could VCs manage to invest $200 billion in the same way that they had previously? Because if they did that, they would end up creating $1.1 trillion of value. Now, that's a number that sounds smaller now, that Apple has reached as a single corporation that amount. But what it meant at the time was quite fuzzy. So sure, they'd had some successes like eBay and Cisco, but those successes weren't the norm. So a very clever Fortune reporter said, here's how you think about it. Let's take eBay, which was one of the few successes of the dot-com boom. At its peak, it had $16 billion in market value, and its venture capitalists made about $4 billion on the investment. And so they ask, how many eBays would we need to create over the next 10 years in order to, at $4 billion per venture capitalist invested, in order to create 18% returns for $200 billion of investment? And the answer was 325. That's more than roughly one eBay every 10 days between now and a decade from now. Now, the modern equivalent of that would be one Facebook every 6 weeks between now and the next decade. But the point is that nobody would have anticipated, until they did that unpacking, how striking that number was and how unlikely it was, because eBay was a big success, and to have one every 10 days would be impossible given the historical record of the industry. That ability to break a large thing down into smaller bits and then to take those small bits and build up to something else bigger, that's the superpower of the analyst. And as part of your analytical toolkit, that ability to break things down and build things up is going to impress the people around you, because it enables them to see things at a greater level of detail or at a larger expanse than they ever could have before. Unfortunately, there's a villain that stands in the way of getting your message communicated to the rest of the organization based on the analysis that you've done. That's a villain that Dan and I talked about in our first brother book, Made to Stick, as the curse of knowledge. The curse of knowledge says, in psychology and economics studies that have studied it, that as we become experts, we become better and better at doing things, but we become worse and worse at talking about those things to other people because we can't imagine what it's like not to know what we know. So if you ever talk to a doctor or a lawyer and you're not trained in those fields, you've been on the other side of the curse of knowledge. But it doesn't take a doctor or a lawyer, fancy person with fancy title, to exhibit the curse of knowledge. Talk to an 11-year-old video gamer, and you will be on the other side of the curse of knowledge. That 11-year-old could not fathom the depths of your ignorance about that game. Let me give you an example of the curse of knowledge that features one of my all-time favorite scientists, British physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking, died in 2018. Hawking came to prominence by imagining what it was like to sit in the edge of a black hole, and he had a very profound question about physics, about whether black holes allow any information to escape, and his conclusion was that they do. But I love the image of a guy who can, from his wheelchair, think about what life is like on the edge of a black hole. Well, when Donald Trump was elected president of the United States, one of the first acts that he took was to remove the United States from the Paris Agreement on climate and environment, trying to limit carbon emissions. And Hawking was incensed by this because he said that if you don't tackle the emissions of the United States, which is the world's biggest source of carbon emissions, then we're more likely to wind up in scenarios in climate science where there's runaway temperature growth. So in a lot of models, there are gradual increases as carbon dioxide increases that make life on Earth more difficult. But some models have additional parameters that lead to predictions that are wildly discrepant from the gradual increase. And so you could wind up with an Earth that's not just an average temperature of, say, 80 degrees or whatever it is, but the average temperature of Earth would be 80 degrees Fahrenheit. The average temperature of Earth would be something like 250 degrees Celsius. And Hawking talked about these models as the Earth would have the climate of Venus. Now, that's a pretty good extrapolation for people that have been to Venus. But the typical citizen of the world probably didn't understand the climate of Venus. And yet, if you look at the number that Stephen Hawking is trying to describe, 250 degrees Celsius, there are some other things that you might want to note about that number before you get to the climate of Venus, which is not a very human scale principle. First thing you want to note is that 250 degrees, the water has boiled off of the Earth's surface about 150 degrees ago. And so there are no more oceans, there are no more streams. The water vapor has all been absorbed into the air. And Stephen Hawking points out that it gets mixed with other things and comes down as sulfuric acid rain. But 250 degrees is also the temperature that you might put on your oven if you want to broil a quick slice of pizza on the top, melt all the cheese very rapidly. And so being in an Earth with 250 degrees Celsius weather is like roasting your arms every time you get a little bit of skin exposed to the sun. It's like opening up the stove in your kitchen and making that top coil glow as brightly red as possible in the highest setting of your oven, and then sticking your face or your arm under that boiler. I would suggest that Stephen Hawking missed that translation, and he did it for a completely understandable reason. He's one of the world's experts on what he was talking about. Most of us have never visited Venus, but Stephen Hawking had. I mean, for Christ's sake, his initial work that brought him prominence by camping out at the side of a black hole. So mentally simulating for him the climate of Venus was no problem at all. But Venus is not concrete. It's not human scale for most people. What is concrete is to imagine opening up your stove and heating that top coil as brightly red as it can and putting your arm under it or putting your face next to it. What maps on for most people is the idea of going to the side of the ocean and the ocean has disappeared. In fact, you could hike to Hawaii if you had the patience and the fortitude, because all of the water has boiled away. In this case, the curse of knowledge diverted Stephen Hawking towards an effective analogy of Venus, as opposed to the tangible, concrete, human scale principles of comparing it to a boiler oven in our kitchen. The longer you become an expert, you're going to become an expert in some field, and the longer you operate in that field, the more and more you're likely to be cursed by your knowledge of that field. And that's the dilemma when we've done an analysis that we're really proud of, is that we're basically stuck in a complex world that we know intimately, but yet at this point we've got to open the door and invite somebody else in and get them to understand our analysis. So as you move up in an organization, you're going to start with analytical problems that are, I'm going to call them easy to solve, even though no problem is really easy to solve, but they're well defined. If you're calculating the return on assets of a new investment or arranging the procurement quantities for the manufacturing operation, those are known problems with known solutions, known classes of solutions. And so all your analysis goes towards asking questions that the organization knows how to answer. The difficulty of being an analyst and moving up in an organization is you're trained to be precise in ways that you can't be precise as you move up in an organization. So two or three or four levels up, we start getting into issues that we can bring numbers and bring them to bear, but we're not going to be able to come up with the crisp answers that we were used to back on the front lines of the organization. And that frustrates a lot of people and stymies them in their careers because they're so reluctant to go outside the bounds of the model. And at the very top of the organization, the most serious decisions are made by people that have maybe a few numbers to use as touch points. But those numbers have to be used in a way that appeals at emotional level to everyone in the organization, because good ideas, if they're going to change an organization, are going to have to cross the boundaries between divisions in the organization. If you're working in the social sector and trying to do climate work or aid work or sustenance work for people, you're going to be in a situation where your ideas have to cross organizational boundaries, moving from one person to another. And the ability to take those abstract numbers and turn them into concrete emotional touch points that bring people together is what's going to make you more successful in your career. And I hope that there are tools in this book that help you take your analysis, move it beyond the technical correctness, and move it into a conversation piece that people can start talking to each other about the analysis. I mean, before the Fortune magazine reporter did the eBay analogy, I could have believed $1.1 trillion of value. I could have believed not. We could argue about it a long time, but as soon as the person specifies what the process is, it all of a sudden becomes transparent to everyone what the right answer is. And that's the idea of good analysis, is it helps you focus and become more concrete in a way that helps you make decisions. I'll leave you with a simple example that I think combines the best of the analytical and emotional kind of things that we've been talking about. This is an example from Kim Werkmeister. She's a senior vice president of improvement and implementation at an organization called Cynosure Health that helps hospitals or maybe owns hospitals and helps them improve their functioning. And she's in particular talking about a hospital in Fairbanks, Alaska that was working on reducing early elective deliveries. So that's a situation where the obstetrician and the family gets involved and decides to arrange a time somewhere around the right birth date, but before 39 weeks, without a true medical indication that this is necessary, that the baby needs to be out of the womb at that point. And so what happens is when you do a an early elective delivery, the babies wind up with problems that they wouldn't necessarily had otherwise. And so some will wind up in the neonatal intensive care unit, or they'll have problems feeding. And what Kim Werkmeister said is that previously, we had published the graphs of the outcomes of these early elective delivery kids, and they weren't having an impact until we made two changes. One is, we instead of abstract dots on a chart, we made little pictures of baby wrapped up in swaddling clothes, and so it looked like baby burritos with just the head of the baby sticking out of that. It's a very cute pictures. And so we replaced each dot on the chart with an icon of a cute baby. The second thing is, for each of those icons, we have just a one-sentence description of something that's going on in the life of that newborn. So, for example, baby A had to spend 2 days in the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit. Or baby C is now at risk for feeding issues long after they leave our care. Now, notice that they're not giving a lot of detail there, but there's a little concrete image that enables people to bond emotionally with that child. And she said, I kid you not, within 3 months of implementing this approach to storytelling with the data, the numbers dropped significantly. And 1 year later, they were reporting zero early elective deliveries. She said, the power of the story is incredible. I love this example because it combines great analytics and great emotion. And so notice that the emotion doesn't have to be over the top. It just has to be an icon of a baby as opposed to a dot on a chart. It has to be one sentence about the outcome of that baby, as opposed to saying nothing at all, or letting the chart give you the inference. And so now numbers people and non-numbers people can both approach that chart, and they both understand what it means, and they understand the implications of what the numbers mean for themselves. And those are the best kinds of numbers, when we can do the right analysis and get the word right, but overcome the curse of knowledge by being very concrete about how we talk about things, by talking about things in human scale, by unpacking what it means to have this number at this stage. And not just understanding the numbers, but making the numbers emotional enough that people care what's going on, to make hard choices, to make hard calls, to reach out to other people and work together. And if you do all that in communicating your numbers, your analysis will not go to waste. All the effort that you put in that would have cursed you with knowledge is going to be overcome, the curse of knowledge, because you have tangible ways of talking to people about things that they really care about. The reason you did the analysis in the first place is you thought this was an important idea. It's important for your organization. And if you can help people understand the implications of your analysis, then you're not just like Superman who could see through walls. You're actually able to make the walls disappear so that everybody can see. Good luck making your numbers count.